This is The Chris Smith Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Thanks very much for tuning in. I'm Mark Latham in for Chris Smith, who's away just for this Tuesday. And can I remind you, if you missed your favourite TNT show or interview, simply listen or watch it when you want, whenever you want, wherever you want. Just visit episodes on the TNT Radio website, rumble.com, bitchute.com, or brighteon.com. We're also on the major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Spotify, Amazon, Podbean, iHeart, and TuneIn. Plenty of choice there. So there's no reason to miss out on anything on today's News Talk TNT. Now, at the top of the program, at the very beginning, I spoke about the inaccuracies inherent in the use of Aboriginal place names in Australia. On a related subject, is it possible to revive the popular use of Aboriginal languages? In New South Wales, where I serve in the Parliament, tens of millions of dollars are being spent on this ambition through government grants and the establishment of Indigenous language trusts and hubs. Schools have also been roped into this woke social engineering agenda. In October 2022, the then National Party Education Minister, Sarah Mitchell, announced an overhaul of the school curriculum to be operational in 2024, so right now. And this was through a new specialist Aboriginal languages syllabus. There was a great hoopla about this in the left media, with the Sydney Morning Herald even declaring, and I quote, most schools would offer the language that was Indigenous to their local area. Well, how is this goal measuring up? From the information provided to me by the New South Wales Education Minister, Prue Carr, and answers to questions I placed on the Upper House notice paper on 28 March, you would have to say terribly. Just six high schools have enrolments in elective Aboriginal language courses. That's one in every 67 government high schools in New South Wales. Only 57 students are enrolled in these courses. It's only 57 statewide, and that's 0.02% of the New South Wales secondary school total. Who are teaching these languages, of which there are hundreds of Aboriginal languages across the various tribes and dialects? The minister answered that there are just 12 qualified teachers in New South Wales working in this area, teaching in front of the class. That's one teacher for every 184 government schools in the state. For the money being outlaid, it hardly seems worthwhile. The main challenge for Indigenous education in Western New South Wales is to get the students to actually attend the school and then to master the basics of English, mathematics, and science. There are not many jobs or businesses relying on Indigenous language skills. The task seems futile. Across Australia, of approximately 300 separate Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages, only around a dozen have survived to the point where the parents still teach them to their children. Only nine of these have more than 1,000 speakers. Even though there are over 70,000 Aboriginal students enrolled in New South Wales government schools, only 2,017, or 2.8% of that Aboriginal cohort, come from homes with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander language background. And what's the reason for this? Well, it highlights how badly the language skills of Indigenous have declined, but also how, in practical terms, the vast majority of Aboriginal families have moved on to English as their first language at home. That's the reality we face. It seems absurd, given the crippling level of Aboriginal truancy in New South Wales, that both the Liberal National Party and now the Labor government have made Aboriginal languages a priority. At the Walgett High School in Western New South Wales, for example, just 3% of Indigenous students attend for 9 days a fortnight or more, the minimum threshold for receiving a decent education. As with Aboriginal place names, the New South Wales languages policy is a form of virtue signalling, although a much more expensive one. It may make the woke elites of inner Sydney, the New South Wales Education Department, and the Teachers Federation warm inside to say they're reviving Indigenous languages, but the evidence shows it's a tiny, tiny part of the Aboriginal experience in our state. It's so small as to be insignificant without the interest and trained teachers needed to make it a success. It's yet another distraction from the genuinely important task of giving Aboriginal students a good education and lifting them out of the poverty cycle that is way too common in our nation, in our state, in our society. So that's the truth. They're the figures that are evident both for Indigenous languages and also for Indigenous place names, as I mentioned an hour ago. Now we're moving on to a new guest. I'm delighted to introduce Tony Wakeham to talk about the problems facing Julian Assange his loss of freedom, the loss of government action to ensure that this Australian citizen can come back to our country. Tony became an active Julian Assange supporter after Julian's incarceration in Her Majesty's prison, Belmarsh, in 2019. He and a small group of other supporters decided to gather on the Sydney Town Hall steps after work every Friday evening until Julian Assange is free. So Tony, a very determined person, has got involved in this worthwhile freedom cause. And it's my pleasure to say welcome to the show, Tony. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you very much for having me today.
Can I ask how you did get involved?
Look, I first became aware of Julian Assange when he was a schoolboy, and he hacked into NASA. That's when he was a hacker, by the way. He's described by the legacy media still as a hacker. That is not true. He was a hacker when he was a schoolboy, when he was 16 years of age, and he hacked into NASA. And he paid the price for that. He then went on to help the Victorian police when he was in his 20s at university in Melbourne. He got on the straight and narrow, and he helped the Victorian police child protection unit track down and break up a pedophile network on the internet back in the 90s, that was. That is not mentioned at all in the media when they discuss him. They continue to character assassinate him, even to this day. ABC, the works, all the commercial media are kind of pretending to follow the case, but they do so in a very jaded and dishonest way. And when he was put in Belmarsh, I thought, oh, this has gone too far. And he's been there now for more than 5 years. And you know, the absolute perversion is the correct word of our legal system, or should I say the Westminster legal system, is beyond the pale. He hasn't faced a jury. He's been assumed to be guilty. And as you know, the Westminster legal system is based on the tenet that we are all innocent until proven guilty by a jury of 12 of our peers. It's common law. That is a fundamental of the common law principle, that we must be found guilty by commoners, by our peers, and not by the state, which is the case for Julian Assange. And in that 5 years, he has exposed more about the corruption of our system than he did in the, 12 years prior to that with WikiLeaks and its exposure of the criminal activities of various members of our states.
Well, Tony, you're obviously a long-time associate of Julian Assange and very dedicated to this cause. You mentioned character assassination, and certainly Alan Howe in the Weekend Australian newspaper didn't hold back. At the top of the article here, it's written, Julian Assange is a criminal, a fabulist, an undisciplined, arrogant, work-shy fraud who lacks an education while remaining a mannerless vulgarian. The WikiLeaks founder is no journalist. Well, my observation about that is that if you've seen reporters up close and some of the things they get up to, particularly late at night, if that's a reason to deny Australian citizens their freedom, then 90% of our journalists would be locked up. So how do you respond to these ongoing hit jobs against Julian Assange, and what do you think motivates them?
That's a very good question, Mark. That's a very, very good question. I think what motivates them is one of two things: money or blackmail. I can think of no other reason why they do this. And what that gentleman is doing is describing his own activities. Julian Assange is not a criminal, has never been a criminal, is an innocent man, and the description that he gives of Julian Assange is more apt to be a description of himself.
Well, can I add a third possible explanation for this? In his closing address to the American people in 1960, President Eisenhower spoke of the military-industrial complex its financial power, obviously, in the production of weapons. But there's no doubt in the United States and also here in Australia, there is a thing called the foreign policy establishment. And anyone who stands up to them by arguing against overseas wars and foreign adventurism, and Julian Assange in this instance put information out there that was counter to the interests of the foreign policy establishment, they do try and squash them like an insect. And he's really been fighting the establishment in that regard, hasn't he?
Absolutely. Oh, no, absolutely. He is trying to, his I guess, motto is that all wars, A-double-L, all wars are started with lies, and that the general population do not want war. You know, the 99% of us do not want war. We want peace. We want to get on with our neighbours. So to start wars, they've got to use lies. They've got to con us into wars. And he set up WikiLeaks to expose those lies. And his motto is, wars are started by lies. Peace can be started with the truth. And that's what his motivation is, if you like.
Well, Alan Howe in The Australian wrote that recklessly dumping classified correspondence on a website is regarded as journalism by nobody. But don't journalists every single day dump material, private information, material they've gained through unorthodox sources, into their newspapers? What's the difference between a journalist publishing material that people didn't want out there and Julian Assange, who published material that governments didn't want out there?
Well, look, Alan Howe has done nothing but expose himself as what he describes. He is a, you know, I don't know why we're even talking about this man. I mean, he's not a journalist. He's a propagandist. That's all he is. And everything he's saying, the mainstream media have been pushing for the last 15 years. It all started actually back in 2008 when John Pilger had an article in Counterpunch on the 18th of June 2018. And he discovered through his sources that a plan was drawn up in 2008 to destroy both WikiLeaks and Assange. And it was a top secret document dated the 8th of March, 2008. The authors were the Cyber Counterintelligence Assessment Branch of the US Defense Department. They described in detail how important it was to destroy the, quote, feeling of trust that is WikiLeaks, quote, center of gravity. This would be achieved, they wrote, with threats of exposure and criminal prosecution and an unrelenting assault on reputation. The aim was to silence and criminalize WikiLeaks and its editor and publisher. It was, if they planned a war on a single human being and on the very principle of freedom of speech, their main weapon would be personal smear. Their shock troops would be enlisted in the media, those who are meant to keep the record straight and tell us the truth. You know, and this war goes on, and it is nothing more than smear, than propaganda. And it's all been exposed in courts. Julian's faced several, I forget, it's dozens of court hearings, and all these things have come out. And it's just pure lies, pure propaganda, nothing more. And it seems that just recently there are a number of people that are perpetrating these lies and nobody believes them anymore. You know, 90% of Australians are awake to them.
Well, Tony, we're talking about Alan Howe, really, to give people like you and other supporters of Julian Assange to give the other side of the story, to give our listeners an alternative point of view, which is what TNT does. But can I just ask, on the 16th of April this year, the Biden administration provided assurances to the UK that Julian Assange would not face the death penalty. How do you view this and other US government assurances?
Well, they can't. They've got a separation of powers. The politicians cannot guarantee what the judges will do. And it's in their assurances, their so-called quote unquote assurances, they say that. So then, as Stella Assange aptly described them, they're non-assurances. They're not worth the paper they're written on. I mean, they've planned to murder this man. There's court sworn testimony that they planned to assassinate Julian Assange. And now they're trying to say that he won't face the death penalty, and he can ask for First Amendment rights. But that's the essence. He can ask for them. They're not guaranteeing he will get them. And history shows us that nobody, no non-American, has ever had First Amendment rights.
Well, that's very true. Tony, stay with us. We're just going to a break and we'll be right back. You're listening to TNT Radio.
TNT's Pella Neuroth-Taylor.
It'd be interesting that if this is kind of Britain's recent soft power exports, we know that the transgender debate and the Scottish censorship law made shockwaves around the world. Who would have thought that Brexit Britain, this country that was founded in the spirit of liberty and for whom Brexit was supposed to be a relaunch of Britain as a country of liberty, has now seems to be exporting censorious attitudes and laws, because just as the smoking ban in pubs law was exported from the British Isles, Ireland, actually, they very quickly spread to the rest of Europe. This law might spread equally quickly. We don't know. So within 5 years' time, a smoking ban for teenagers and then kept up as they grow older might spread to the whole of Europe. So Europeans, listen up.
Pella Neuroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission.
Ladies and gentlemen,
today's News Talk.
News and information.
TNT Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Latham on TNT, talking to Tony Wakeham, a very strong and determined advocate, effective advocate for Julian Assange. Tony, can I just ask, the US government argues that Julian violated the Espionage Act by soliciting, obtaining, and then publishing classified information. What do you see the biggest flaws in the US government's position? I suppose most notably, it was one of their own, wasn't it, Chelsea Manning, who leaked the information?
Well, Chelsea Manning leaked that information to WikiLeaks. And I'll note that there's a law in the US that makes it illegal to keep illegal acts secret. So what Julian exposed were illegal acts. I mean, it's espionage. Let's remember what espionage is. Espionage is about secretly gaining secrets from your enemy and passing them to your government so that they can clandestinely use those secrets to somehow gain an advantage over their adversary.
Yeah, like a spy, but Julian Assange is anything but a spy.
Correct. I mean, to be charging him under the Espionage Act is a farce, is an absolute farce. He couldn't be further from a spy. He's like the reverse to a spy. He's making this information public. I mean, what can I say? You know, they're fallacious charges, and it's crime. He's exposing crime. You know, he's won more journalism awards for these things. He's won a gold Walkley Award in Australia in 2010. You know, 14 years ago, for this exact revelations that he brought forth, that he's now being charged with under the Espionage Act. So there's a real disparity about the way the Australian Media and Entertainment Arts Alliance see his revelations and the way the US military see his revelations. You know, they couldn't be further apart.
Yeah, I wish we had more people exposing the failings of the Iraq War, for example, a massive military disaster based on false information. And we're still paying the penalty for it today in the instability in the Middle East. So more power to people like Julian Assange, who tried to do the right thing and give the public valid information as to what had gone wrong.
Well, it was WikiLeaks revelations that got the Iraq government to kick the Yanks out finally. I mean, they hung around like a bad smell right through. You know, they went in there illegally. There was nothing connecting Iraq with 9/11, nothing, zero. It was, you know, from the get-go, we knew that was fake. We knew that was a lie. And yet they hung around for 20 years.
Yeah, no weapons of mass destruction never found, and George Bush never faced any penalty.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And a million Iraqis are dead because of that. A million. I mean,
it's just going back a bit further, Tony, in the allegations against Julian. In December 2010, he was arrested in the UK over a rape allegation in Sweden. Hasn't it been proven that this was a false allegation and used for political purposes? From your experience in talking with average citizens in your campaign, do you think most Australians understand that the mud thrown at Julian Assange is politicised and completely lacks substance?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've been on the streets for 5 years, and let me tell you, 5 years ago, everybody believed those rape allegations. And everybody, you know, the vast majority of Australians couldn't give a toss about Julian Assange. And we've seen that completely turn around. Now we've got, you know, the best part of, at last count, 90% of Australians are firmly behind Julian. So much so that our government, finally, the Albanese government has stood up, and the Australian Parliament, the Australian Federal Parliament, has stood up in support of Julian Assange.
Yeah, were you happy with that vote? You must have been to see the Federal Parliament vote so decisively in favour of Julian Assange's freedom. It's quite a turnaround, as you say. What was the exact vote in the House of Representatives, and who are the strongest advocates that you work with?
Well, there's about, at my count, there's about five decent politicians in the Australian Federal Parliament. The rest are riding, you know, they realise, look, the Labor government realised that if they want to get in at the next election, they better get on board with Julian. You know, this is democracy at work, what we're seeing.
Do you think Albanese's doing enough? He says he's got a good close relationship with President Joe Biden. Is he doing enough to secure Julian's freedom?
Well, no, is my answer. No. He's only pretending, I believe, to do things. There's nothing on the record, absolutely nothing on the record. I mean, people are doing, you know, searches into what he's been said and done. Nothing's been done. Nothing's been done. I mean, it's all spin. And it's all spin because he wants to get voted in at the next federal election. No, look, I'm disgusted at both the Liberal and Labor governments for what they haven't done for Julian. And, you know, we've only got to look back a few prime ministers to Julia Gillard, and she proclaimed he was guilty, even though he had not faced any charges at that time.
Yeah, she was just a parrot for the American line, and it was quite disgraceful. But right now, President Biden has suggested he's considering a request by Australia to end the decade-long push to persecute and prosecute Julian Assange. What do you read into that?
Well, I think America's waking up. America's still asleep. When I talk to American visitors to Australia, tourists in Australia, most of them, and I mean the vast majority, have not even heard the name Julian Assange. They are oblivious to this, but it's now getting traction. We've got Tucker Carlson in America that's pushing this cause. He, as you know, is one of the most popular journalists of the American media, and others are coming on board. And as they are, and as the Americans are waking up to this. I mean, they've got the First Amendment. They're the only country in the world that actually protects journalism, protects free speech. And when the Americans wake up to it, which they are starting to through people like Tucker Carlson, then look out for the political elite who have been covering this up and hiding it, along with their media associates, for 15 years. I mean, it's outrageous, and it's going to end. And it's going to end because people, the American people, are going to hear the name Julian Assange, and they're going to hear about his exposure of their criminal behaviour in these far-off countries.
Well, progress is being made on this slowly, hopefully, through the work of people like yourself, Tony Wakeham. You've been a wonderful advocate and supporter, so we congratulate you on that. Thank you for your time on the show and wish you all the best. And I hope we hear that good news that Julian Assange can return to his country of origin, Australia, and have the freedom that's been denied for him for so long now. So thanks for your time, Tony, and we'll talk again. Right now, we'll go to the news headlines and be right back. This is TNT Radio.
I have a little news flash.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan with your TNT headlines. Australia's Prime Minister's lashed out at ex-boss Elon Musk as the billionaire goes into battle to protect free speech.
I just find it extraordinary that this bloke thinks he's above the law.
The UK will start detaining migrants within days after plans to send them to Africa was approved by Parliament.
No ifs, no buts. These flights are going to Rwanda.
And 10 people have been killed in a horror mid-air collision involving two military helicopters in Malaysia.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. For the news and views silenced by the mainstream media, by government and corporations, vote one. TNT Radio. Free speech always has a home here. Stay up to date with the latest live news and current affairs delivered by our lineup of expert commentators and hosts. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the show, and it's my pleasure to welcome to TNT Radio, George Christensen. George is editor of Eureka Free Press website and Nation First Substack newsletter. He's a former member of the Australian House of Representatives for the division of Dawson, representing the National Party, but has moved on since then. He's certainly a strong advocate for his beliefs, a conservative, a Christian, a freedom lover, a blogger, a podcaster, a journalist, a theologian, and George, you're a glutton for punishment. I see you've now been re-elected or come back to politics, elected to the Mackay Regional Council, an unusual step for someone who was once in the Australian House of Representatives to go to local government. Can I just give you, as a bit of a disagreement on these things, two precedents? Bill Morrison was a minister in the Whitlam government and a member for St George on two occasions. He was a defence minister at the end of 1975. He served on the Rockdale Council in Sydney in the early 90s, so he jumped federal to local. And more recently, Michael Forshaw, who you might remember, a Labor senator from New South Wales, is, I think, still on the Sutherland Shire Council, or certainly has been until recent times. So you're not the only one who's jumped from federal politics to local, but what made you do it?
Temporary insanity, maybe, Mark. But look, at the it's good to be back in that arena, because I was there 20 years ago. I think you were once in local government yourself.
Yes.
You were mayor of Liverpool, if I'm not mistaken.
Was.
Is that right? That's right.
Yeah.
And I think we've got some other examples of people who've done it in reverse as well. Jo Gash, in recent history, the Liberal, she became a mayor, I think, actually as she was serving her tail end of her federal MPship. And one of the state Labor ministers, Tony McGrady, became mayor of Mount Isa. So it happens now and then, but I was asked, Mark, and there were local problems and they needed to be fixed. Before we get going, I'm just sorry about the location. I'm in a Qantas lounge at the moment, about to fly back into Mackay after meetings in Brisbane. So a lot of noise going on. I hope it doesn't distract you and the listeners.
Well, it looks pretty good there. I was once kicked out of the Qantas Chairman's Lounge by Alan Joyce, so I don't know if you're in the Chairman's Lounge. If you are, you're doing a lot better than I am these days. But we'll persevere, notwithstanding the sound problems in the background there, George, well, one of the campaigns you're taking up at the moment is hands-off homeschooling. And it has been phenomenal. You point out that there are almost 50,000 homeschooling students around Australia and over 10,000 in Queensland alone. And the numbers right across the country have exploded since the end of the COVID pandemic. It seems to me that parents, it's not just the dissatisfaction with government schooling and the fact they did some homeschooling during COVID. They actually got to see what was being taught in the government schools. Hasn't that been a driver of parents saying, well, we'll keep the kids here at home, because we saw on the screen the things that are being taught in the classroom at times?
100%. You're 100% right. I'm running that campaign on behalf of an organisation called Citizen Go, of which I'm the Australian Campaigns Manager. It's an organisation that's global but dedicated to defending life, family and liberty. And one of the things that we saw that affected two of those elements, family and liberty, was this attack on homeschooling. But you're absolutely right. It's an interesting phenomenon. Homeschooling since the pandemic has doubled across Australia. In Queensland, it's tripled. That's been an explosion. And, you know, the insiders that I speak to within Queensland government, Queensland Parliament, and even the Education Department actually tell me that there was some worry about that from government circles. You know, why was it happening? What were these kids being taught? Why are they being removed? Well, I think you're right, Mark. The fact is that they're saying all of these disgraceful things that are being taught through state schools, we could even say through private schools these days, you know, they absolutely become so livid about it, they've removed the kids from the classroom. 10,000 families in Queensland homeschooling children, 50,000 across Australia. They're big numbers, But when you see things like that recent school that got in, I think it was Headspace speakers to talk to kids about sexuality and then started talking to them about bestiality, you wonder why parents are opting to take education into their own hands.
Well, these state Labor governments tend to be handmaidens to the Teachers Federation. The Federation doesn't like homeschooling because it's fewer teachers and fewer union members, most particularly. So what has the Queensland Labor government been proposing to try and knock homeschooling on the head, this negative?
Well, they brought in this bill. First, there was rumblings in the media late last year where they were talking about outliers and extreme cases. And Mark, you know, as a parliamentarian, whenever you hear government using extreme examples as a reason to do something, you know there's a setup coming. So what they proposed was ramping up the paperwork to levels where they would probably need a consultant to actually come in and help them with that paperwork to show that they are actually, you know, doing the schooling properly. Second thing is, and this is the much more concerning one, is that they were going to require homeschoolers to teach to the national curriculum. Now, right now they don't have to. And so what ends up happening, Mark, is they go around globally and they access high-quality curriculum, whether that might be classical education sort of line or Montessori or Charlotte Mason or whatever kind of education that you want, often comes to a much higher standard, actually, than the national curriculum, but different things are taught. They don't put the emphasis on gender fluidity, Mark. They don't put the emphasis on climate change. They don't put the emphasis on the black armband view of Australian history. And those things actually really do usurp the fundamentals when it comes to education. And so, yeah, you would have had a situation where a state government was forcing parents to teach their kids things that they never actually wanted to teach. That was the reason they pulled them out of the state schooling system, so that they didn't have to teach that. It was, diabolical. But I got to say, the good news is the Queensland government, I don't know if they saw sense or just saw the numbers of angry people, because two petitions got about 20,000 each onto them. And, in fact, one of them got up to 23,000. And they dropped it pretty quick smart after that.
Well, good. Congratulations on the success of your campaign. I mean, if you support parental choice, you're supporting homeschooling, making it easier for parents to make that particular choice. But it's incumbent upon the education ministers not to put schooling on the head with red tape and other restrictions, but actually improve the quality of government schooling so it's more attractive for those teachers. It's an admission of failure, isn't it, when they try and knock around homeschooling and make it harder for the parents?
It absolutely is. And indeed, I think that that was completely the focus here. They wanted that explosion curtailed. They wanted to rope a whole heap of these parents back into the mainstream state schooling system. And I think that there was fear, probably the right choice of word there, fear from the education bureaucrats that they weren't able to indoctrinate these kids with the things that they think kids should be taught. And my fear and the fear of many parents across the nation is that Queensland was just the first cab off the rank. If they were successful in doing this, we would have saw state governments make moves on homeschools right across the nation, Mark. So, look, I don't know if it's been knocked on the head fully. It's been given a bit of a stay of execution. The organisation I referred to earlier, Citizen Go, we're trying to get it completely knocked on the head by getting some of those Labor backbenchers that are in marginal seats that you never ever hear from to actually speak out and actually say they won't support these changes coming back. We'll see whether that happens or not.
Well, you've got a Queensland election later in the year, so a very good issue, particularly in those marginal seats, to back in homeschooling, back in parental choice and back in the needs of those students who just want the basics being taught rather than woke, transgender and other left-wing ideology. So well done on that front. We'll just take a break, George. Stay with us and we'll be back in a while here on TNT Radio.
I was such a young age. Everything changed. My name is Chloe. When I was 13, my dad was diagnosed with cancer. When I found out, I just didn't know how to react. I felt like everything was just kind of closing in on me. It just became a routine. Dad's doing chemo. I'd come home from school, wait for mum to finish work, and we'll go straight to the hospital, spend a few hours there, just draw. It was hard to navigate going to school, hundreds of kids, and I was the only one with a dying dad. He was diagnosed in March, and then he died in October. Towards the end, I heard about canteen. It kind of felt nice to know that they had other people like me. They understood what I was going through and we didn't even have to chat about cancer. In 2020, I became a youth ambassador so I can help others the way they helped me. I've done so many things since I was 13. I've graduated high school, university, gotten my license, made a move across the country. Life now is just a whole lot more fun. Please give a gift today to support more young people like me experiencing cancer.
When a crisis hits close to home, and across the globe, nonprofits are on the front lines, ready to serve. Healing. Nurturing. Rescuing. Protecting. Inspiring. The work of philanthropic organizations has never been more important. And it's donors and volunteers like you who make all this possible. Thank you. The Nonprofit Alliance.
The voice of a changing world. Chris Smith on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
I'm Mark Latham talking to George Christensen, doing great work in Queensland on a range of issues. But George, we mentioned transgender ideology in schools. You've done some work in reviewing the UK CAS report, which seems to me to be a landmark report. The UK went down the path of transgender ideology ahead of other nations, including Australia. What can we learn from their experience?
Mate, the CAS report is damning about what Australia is doing, because what Australia is doing is exactly what the UK is doing right now, what the Tavistock Clinic has been doing. They follow pretty much the same set of guidelines. There's been a bit of rubbish here in Australia spoken about how our guidelines for handling treatments of kids that are gender confused is different to that of the European experience. It's not. It's exactly the same. And so everything that the CAS report says is relevant. CAS report says that, this is the actual medical interventions in gender confused kids should not happen. So that means, Mark, no puberty blockers, no chemical castrations, no bodily modification surgeries. That stuff should be absolutely ruled out when it comes to young people. It goes hand in hand with a recent study that popped out of the Netherlands, I believe, which actually showed that they did a 15-year-long study looking at kids that were gender confused and tracked how they proceeded into adulthood. And for most of them, it passed relatively quickly. It went down to just 4%. 4% of that cohort who were gender confused were still gender confused into adulthood. So what does that tell you? If all of those kids had been allowed to take puberty blockers, to have their, if girls have their breasts lopped off, or if their boys have penectomies or whatever they have, that would have been diabolical, Mark, because, at the end of the day, they would have been mutilated, they would have been scarred, they would have been psychologically scarred as well. And indeed, this has happened. This is why this CAS report came out in the UK, because someone successfully sued the Tavistock Clinic because, they were a kid when it happened, when they did all this stuff to them. And now it's irreversible for that person. They are suffering. They are suffering because they actually didn't want it. They didn't understand. They didn't understand the implications of what these doctors were doing to them. But in Australia, we're doubling down on it, Mark. We're defending it. And there has been a huge explosion. Go back and have a look. I think it was from the year 2011 to 2021, I might be mistaken on those dates, but it was over a 10-year period anyway, in one hospital in Melbourne alone, the increase in kids that were admitting for dysphoria, that actually wanted some form of transgender-type treatment, surged 10,000%. 10,000%. Now, I don't know about you, Mark, but that does not sound like a naturally occurring thing. Something else is actually going on with that. I don't know what it is, but we're not allowed to ask any of these questions in Australia. It's just, accepted, and the CAS report is not getting looked at by federal or state health ministers.
No, we're not learning the lessons. We've had a similar experience in New South Wales with a facility in Newcastle called Maple Leaf House that's had an explosion in numbers, young people going there for these treatments. But it's a very unusual area of medicine, isn't it, in that the children are allowed to diagnose their own condition. And seemingly if a 13-year-old boy goes in and says, I'm really a girl, these medical practitioners don't stop to say, well, let's watch and wait to see how that plays out. It seems that the self-diagnosis is accepted and away they go. I chaired a parliamentary inquiry into, in part, parental rights and transgender in our school system. And I agree with your assessment. We've probably concluded about 10% of the transitions were genuine, but the rest were a product of loneliness, medical conditions like Asperger's, a cry for attention and recognition in the school, fads, pranks, how does a boy get in the girl's toilet? 90% of the cases weren't genuine. So you need to watch and wait and see how these young people play out rather than jumping in and making gender transitions that are very harmful and need to be reversed in the future.
And, Mark, I would say that one thing to add to that conversation is the old adage, follow the money. There was a couple of recent articles in just probably the last year or two in magazines like Time where they referred to, there's another one that I just can't bring to mind at the moment, but Forbes, I think it was, where they were talking about the industry, the transgender medical industry. It's now a thing, Mark, and they were saying that that by 2030 it would be in the hundreds of billions of dollars. So this is big pharma, this is big medicine. They're rubbing their hands with glee while governments sit and do nothing, but allow kids to be experimented on with drugs that they use to chemically castrate sex offenders. They're letting kids have their bits lopped off, all in the name of diversity and, transgenderism and feel good nonsense. It should not be allowed. So I don't know, Mark. I think that these doctors that get involved in this, like they have in the UK, they're going to be liable in the future. But I also wonder the politicians that are sitting on their hands, what liability is going to be for them. Surely there's moral liability, that's for sure.
Well, a lot of politicians are scared. They're scared to speak out. You know, I give a lot of credit to J.K. Rowling in the UK. He's out there on social media doing wonderful work in this space, and people like yourself. But it's an area where you're easily cancelled if you run against the woke orthodoxy on this. But Tavistock was once part of an industry in the UK. It's closed, and I hope we see the same thing with the clinics we've been talking about in Australia. Just on another topic, George, can I get your take on the question of social media censorship, and in particular the high-profile clash today between the Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, and Elon Musk, the owner and person who manages Twitter, formerly now known as X?
Well, more power to X and more power to Elon. I you know, hope he gives Albo the big finger, because, and he can. What can they do to him? They're going to say, oh, we're going to fine you $500,000 a day. Well, firstly, I think his bank account can afford that. Secondly, I actually don't think he would pay anyway. How are they going to make him pay? What are they going to shut down Twitter in Australia? Have they not heard of the fact that we can all access VPNs and go and get Twitter anyway? So really the government is behind the times technologically, thinking that they can take on a social media giant like this. But it's interesting, there are so many things you could take on the tech giants for. I mean, before Musk, Twitter was riddled with child sex content. Facebook also has the same problem, right? But instead of tackling that aspect, as I thought that an e-safety commissioner would be wanting to look at those things, what they're talking about is taking down so-called misinformation. As someone some way put it on Facebook the other day, if as the lefties all say, Mark, if your truth and my truth are all truth, truth's relative, how can there possibly be misinformation? But in all seriousness, that's just a code word that means political censorship. We want to censor the things that we disagree with, and this idea that it all stems down to this attack on that Eastern or Coptic Orthodox, actually it's a Syrian Church of the East, Bishop Mar Murray Emmanuel, and the video footage of him being attacked. Why are we wanting to censor that stuff? I mean, yes, surely it is violent, but we see more violent things on the news. Why can't it be on X? Why can't it be on Facebook? Why can't it be on YouTube? I sort of don't understand this. If we want to stop, if we want to get rid of all violent imagery, well, how about we start with commercial TV and the ABC?
Well, it does make you.
Why is it different for them?
Yeah, well, I think it's all politics, really. They set up the Orwellian-type bureaucrats, the safety commissioner, but they've got politics too, and it seems to be a left-wing agenda that's propagated more than anything else, because on social media you can still access imagery from the Link Cafe siege in Sydney, the Bali bombing, 9/11. Your former colleague Matt Canavan today pointed out, I think, excellently how the imagery of Kumanjai Walker, his death in the Northern Territory in 2019, that's still accessible. Those videos can still be seen. Divisive, perhaps encouraging other problems in the community. Why the protection of this attack on the Assyrian bishop in the church in Wakeley in Fairfield in Western Sydney? You'd have to say, well, they're worried about mosques being attacked, aren't they? They're worried about counterattacks on Muslims. So it comes back to a very, very collective agenda, doesn't it? Like, that's a rational interpretation of what's going on here.
That pretty much is a rational interpretation. You know, it goes with the narrative that, we can have a footage up there on social media of a police officer shooting an Aboriginal person, because that says all police officers are bad and Aboriginal people are the victims always when it comes to that kind of event or tragedy. But in this instance, it's a Muslim attacking a Christian priest or a Christian clergyman. That goes quite against the narrative, because Islam is the religion of peace, you know, Mark. You know, it's a religion of peace that possibly can't happen. And Christians can never be victims, mate. We're the perpetrators. So I think that you're right. It's very selective. But beyond that issue, there is real concern I have got, and so many others have got, about this e-safety commissioner, how she is pushing the government censorship agenda. I mean, she went over to the World Economic Forum not so long ago and told them that free speech needed to be regulated. You can't have regulated free speech markets. It's free or it's not. And it seems in Australia the decision has been made by government that it's not going to be free speech. That's why they proposed that combating misinformation and disinformation bill. And what we've seen in the last couple of days on this issue will be like that on steroids and then some if that bill ever sees the light of day.
Well, it's a big worry, and you'd think that it'll be all politics as well. I mean, you can have a political definition of what's information and what's misinformation and act accordingly, and, you know, it's a huge concern. But are you worried that the opposition leader, Peter Dutton, has offered the government bipartisan support in this social media censorship? I mean, how can we be talking about reining in social media? Yeah, some of it is bad, but, I mean, the option is there for free-thinking citizens not to consume that product.
Look, you know, if you don't want kids seeing this on social media, then ensure that you have to be 18 or over to jump on social media. I probably have no problem with that, Mark. If parents wanted to sign up and have their kids accessing their accounts, go for your life. But I just don't know that grown adults should be stopped from viewing things that the government deems is violent, politically incorrect, not woke enough to be looked at, you know, whatever it is. The government shouldn't be dictating that. You know, I should be dictating that as a grown adult.
Why do you think Australia's gone down this nanny state pathway? The antithesis of the Australian ethos of larrikinism, freedom, up yours to the authorities, up yours to the establishment. Why have we allowed so much of the nanny state to emerge where we need government to hold our hand and tell us how to think and act?
Very good question, Mark, and I don't have all the answers, but what I know is that this sort of nonsense about combating misinformation and disinformation started actually under the Liberals when I was a member of the coalition government, and I raised concerns then about it. In fact, my push within the government for what it was worth was to go the opposite way, that we should be cracking down on social media platforms for censoring people for philosophical and political and cultural discourse, because they're either platforms or they're publishers, and if they're publishers and doing content moderation, they should be liable for defamation for anything that's said on their social media sites. But they're not; they're platforms, and so platforms should be able to, within the constraints of the law, and I'm talking about things like, you know, child sex content and other, you know, things like that. They should be. It should be a free platform for people to say whatever they want to say on it. So why government's gone down that path, I don't know. I can only speculate that this is just all about political control, getting control of the narrative. If they can silence you, I mean, look at that misinformation and disinformation bill. Talked about two key things there. One of them was harms involving the environment. How can any speech or post on Facebook or Twitter be harmful to the environment? And that's what they're talking about, is climate change, Mark, and not being able to speak out against the climate change myth. They also talked about speech that harms your health. How can speech harm your health? Unless, of course, they're talking about another pandemic and people who naysay about government protocols for that pandemic. So this is the danger. I do believe it is all about control.
Yeah, I think the problem is that MPs can come into the parliament, say notionally right of centre, Liberal National Party, and say they're in favour of citizen freedom. But as an MP, you're always looking for things to do. And some of those things to do is to take on extra government power to control what citizens do. And all of a sudden, you've gone 180 degrees and you're counter to the philosophy that brought you into public life in the first place. That's my observation over a long period of time. The worst thing that can ever happen to an MP is to unnecessarily look for things to do for the sake of it, whether that's votes in a marginal seat or impress colleagues or get a story in the media. But that is the real disease of modern politics. I'm glad to say, George, as much as I can, I've tried to resist that over the years. I know that you have. You are a fighter for freedom, and I think that's the example we need to continue to set in public office. So I'm glad to hear you're back in the battle there on the Mackay Council. I hope you can get back into a Parliament, Queensland or National one day. Thanks for being on the show. We're coming to the end of our 2 hours. I'm sure you'll be on TNT into the future. I look forward to that. Thanks to everyone for listening, and I'll see you down the track back as a regular guest for the great Chris Smith. Thank you.